Welcome to the Visual Impact Podcast, bringing you conversations and insights from the world of filmmaking. I'm Rob Newton, and today we are talking to cinematographer Tycho Poulakakis, CSC, about his work on the sci-fi TV series Foundation. Tycho is known for his work on American Gods, Lock and Key, Star Trek Discovery, and 12 Monkeys. Hi Tycho, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today we are talking about your work, obviously, on the new Apple TV Plus TV series Foundation, which is based on the books by Isaac Asimov. I've been watching the series and it looks fantastic, I've got to say that.
Thank you.
From the vast silent vistas of the stars, the planets, the sprawling futuristic cityscapes, and the gorgeous costumes. It really is, and I congratulate you on bringing the books to life.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. It was obviously a huge team effort.
Sure, of course, yeah. But there've been several attempts before, haven't there, in the past, to try and get this into film or onto TV. Why do you think it's worked so successfully this time?
I think probably, obviously the sort of great will and perseverance of David Gore would have to be mentioned, number one. Number two, I think, and maybe to the chagrin of the people who are saying that it should be 100% faithful to the book, I think David realized that he couldn't be 100% faithful to what Isaac Asimov had done and decided to sort of take the book as a starting point and as a point of inspiration and then sort of try to bend the story into a watchable, workable kind of filmic event, as opposed to just trying to be as faithful as he could to the book. They're not that easy to translate into film. They're full of really great ideas, but they're, you know, and this has been said elsewhere, they're rather dry visually. So, you know, it was a bit of a balancing act. I think he's done a good job of it.
At what point were you brought on board to shoot it?
I was brought on board after they had completed most of the principal photography on the pilot, which was directed by Rupert Sanders and shot by Steve Annis. And so then we jumped in to do a three-series block with director Alex Graves shortly after that. So basically they had shot, I think, from September, October, November, maybe. I'm not sure of their start date, into the December of 2018, I believe. And then we came in January 2019 to do our bit. And do the three series block there. So we were there for some time then. Last year.
So had the overall look of the TV series been created by then, or did you have any flexibility for when you did your three block?
I think we did have quite a bit of flexibility because they looked at the pilot and there's things that they absolutely loved, and I think it's always the same. Often, the first time, and it's very hard to get everything right out of the gate. So there was many things that they loved that had happened in that, but there was a whole lot they wanted to change. So kind of tasked myself and Alex with changing some of it. I think we did definitely an homage to what had begun and maybe took a few things in a different direction visually and decided to go off in our own way for a few things, definitely.
Okay. I mean, was that due to some sort of research that you'd done previously, in terms of, to get some inspiration, maybe from the book, the cover of the books originally and that sort of thing? Or was it, purely what you created when you and Alex got together?
I think, like I said, when they wanted to sort of change a bit of a direction, it was a long conversation between myself and Alex. David obviously had a lot to do with it, and Rory Shane, the production designer, Chris McLean, the VFX supervisor, and we all kind of sat down and said, okay, well, what do we like? What do we want to change? Which way we want to go and why? There was something that I really loved about Steve, certain moments of naturalism. And I think that's something that I latched onto, in my own approach, because there's a tendency in science fiction sometimes to go a little bit crazy, like in the lighting gets a little crazy and the colors can get a little crazy. And we felt, at least I felt a lot of the time, and I think everybody concurred, hopefully, they haven't told me otherwise, that going in that, staying in that sort of direction, not going too over the top, would be a good approach. And I mean, it was a work in progress, too, as we kind of went along. you know, we also did the same thing. We took elements that we like, and we expanded them or echoed them in later bits of shooting, and then things that we thought, okay, well, that didn't work so well, let's sort of push that to the side. So it was kind of definitely a work in progress, as most, I think, first seasons are.
Sure. And have you worked with Alex before, the director?
No, we hadn't worked before. We first met on this job, yeah, and got thrown into the fire, literally, together. So it's good.
Yeah, I mean, certainly watching those three episodes, it seemed there was a sort of shared vision between the two of you. You know, you could see that, you know, there was a good relationship just looking at it, I think.
That's nice to hear, for sure. Yeah, I mean, that's always the hope. I mean, in the sense that I think a DP's job a lot of the times is to sort of bring a director's idea to life, and then, you know, like sort of help the story. You know, 9/10 of, I think, what we try to do, then that's lovely to hear that you felt that way.
And I don't know whether, you may not know this, but whether there was any involvement with Robin Asimov and Apple in the process of what it should look like?
Yeah, apparently she was not so much in what it looked like. She was quite involved with David in the beginning about some of the changes that he wanted to make, as I understand it. So he, like, things that have different from the book. The super clever device that I think he came up with the dynastic, the sort of genetic dynasty, which I thought was a really kind of interesting take on the book and a clever sort of visual device and storytelling device. She signed off on things like that. And also the gender flipping, some of the main characters. I think she very much down with that. So I think they stayed in touch throughout the post-production. And she's read a few of the scripts, I know that much, and they stayed in touch throughout post-production, and they have a good working relationship. So, she's been a part of it, but not in the visual sense, I don't think, more just working with David in the story.
Sure. There's obviously multiple DOPs on the show, isn't there, in terms of different episodes and collaborations. So what were the challenges, would you say, in maintaining a consistent look for the series when you've got different people shooting different episodes?
That's super challenging. I mean, everybody that came on board throughout the whole thing, I think, is quite talented. And we're like anything, we can't be exactly the same. So I remember once we'd sort of taken off in our direction with Alex and the other DPs were coming on board, and I was working at the same time with Darren Tiernan. And lots of times we sort of, you know, come to the end of, because we were shooting simultaneously. We come to the end of the day and he'd go, "What'd you do?" And I'd be like, "I did this. What'd you do?" He's like, "Oh, geez, I did that." So I think the important thing with that, because no two DPs are ever going to light the same scene exactly the same ever, which is probably a good thing. But the idea is that if, as long as it sort of feels the same, because it's never going to look exactly the same, but as long as it has the same sort of feeling visually, then I think that goes a long way to trying to make a cohesive, you know, piece of storytelling.
Yeah.
And now there's been great successes in that and the series, I'm sure, and some maybe minor failures, hopefully in the minor, where the discerning viewer might see some glaring differences. But I think that was the idea. And, you know, people were pretty faithful to it. So good. We had a lot of people, you know, and a lot of very talented people throwing in on that. So good.
Yeah. As you say, it's nice to have sort of a road to go down, but you can deviate a little bit now and again just to, as you said, bring your own personality in.
That's kind of the great thing about science fiction, because you go to a new world and you can throw out all the rules and, you know, try again, or you get on a new ship and you can be like, "Oh, I'm going to try this on this ship." Or so there's a lot of room to kind of go and play, to kind of go in a different direction. And, you know, and sometimes, obviously, I think that was one thing, and it's a testament to the talent of everyone involved. They always let the story be the guide to that. So I don't think anybody was particularly ran off in a particular direction for its own sake. I think we always had sort of interesting discussions, you know, in the fog of war there as we passed each other on a crowded set, like, about how and why those things should be the way they were. And I think that part was a success for sure.
Did you bring members of your regular crew on board?
The crew was entirely in place by the time I showed up.
Right.
There was turnover in the camera department in terms of camera operators. So it was meeting everybody for the first time when we landed. And thankfully, everybody was fantastic and, and really easy to work with. And yes. Really trying hard to think of any exception to that. But I don't think there was a single one. The crew was phenomenal. And, now I can even, I sort of call the vast majority of them that I worked with friends. So, yeah, it worked out really, really, really well. Very talented bunch here at Ireland.
Oh, so they were all from Ireland, the crew?
For the most part, there's, notable exceptions would be Dave Morgan, who's from Liverpool. He was their A-camera operator and Steadicam operator, fantastic guy. And then for a small bit when during the craziness of COVID, another gentleman, Rob Carter from Bristol, came in. He was fantastic as well. But for the most part, the core crew camera grip and lighting was Irish.
Right. And could you just tell us a bit about the camera and lens package that you used?
Yeah, how long have we got? it was a crazy ride that way. And actually, I think in some ways, you wouldn't want to do this on purpose. But the fact that it happened to us by accident, I'm sort of starting to see as a virtue. So to make a short story long, Steve had started with the DXL2 and a set of T-Series to shoot the pilot. And I think, that worked out really wonderfully. I'm a huge fan of Pendleton Gas. But when the schedule broke down the way it did, and because we were in so many locations, and because of some changes in personnel and the need to shoot multiple units, up to three and then four if you include a drone team at the same time, we kind of found it impossible to kind of continue down the road with Panavision, just the availability of the glass that we wanted. So it was a bit of an abrupt change, and then we kind of went from the DXL to the LS, and then a set of Zeiss Supreme to make, just to functionally get the show back on the road, so to speak. And then about, I'd say a third of the way through the shooting, we really missed the anamorphics. So we got two sets of Atlas Orion anamorphics from the lovely people in California. They're lovely, excellent, easy to work with, fantastic, great people. And they helped us out even with a couple of prototypes. And we sort of bounced back and forth between the Zeiss's and those to sort of kind of keep the visual language somewhat the same. There's quite a mix of things going on there. And at first, I was a little nervous about it, I have to be honest, but then just having that flexibility with the spherical versus the anamorphic, and each of those lenses having their own wonderful properties, it turned out to be really cool. Because there's times you're like, it'd be really great here. I want a fantastically shallow depth of field, so I'm going to stay with the Supremes, or I really want this to have that anamorphic feel or flare. So, we're going to switch back to these for that, to the Atlases. So it was really actually kind of cool. And it sort of broke that taboo that was in my mind. It's like, okay, well, you get a lens package, you stick with it, you try to keep it the same. It was a beautiful mistake, put it that way, I guess, in the sense that we're sort of making it up as we went along. And I'm sort of glad we did. Now we're going back to, season two is going back to the DXL and Panavision glass, but it's still a mix of Panavision glass. It's not, we're going to, have a couple sets of ultra vistas. Again, because of the sprawling nature of the show, multiple locations, multiple units, we're going to have to supplement that with some E-Series, some Primo RTs, and a bunch of other stuff. So it'll be fun. I'm kind of into that now. I don't know.
Sure. As you say, sometimes, things emerge as you're going along and shooting it, and it turns out better or more flexible than you thought you were going to do in the first place. So in terms of locations, it's obviously been shot in lots of different areas, Ireland, Malta, Iceland, I think, Canary Islands and Germany. Where did you shoot your episodes?
Almost all of our studio work was in Ireland. And then we had some location work in Malta and all the water work. I think all of our underwater work and above and like our sort of on water work was in Malta. We did a really fascinating, because of COVID, we had to shoot a whole sequence of Gail and her mother walking through Synapse, and there was a sort of practical location in Germany. Yeah. Because of COVID, we couldn't go. So we had a whole plate shoot that was sort of done remotely, just pretty fascinating, where we shot all the requisite plates for the walk and talk and their travel through the village. And then we shot their walk against the blue scene in Malta. So I'd never done that before. That was pretty interesting. And I think worked out really well. It worked out brilliantly. You don't even know if you, I mean, I noticed it just slightly because I know what happened, but yeah. I don't think the uninitiated would have any idea.
Sure.
Canaries with all the stuff in Terminus was shot in the Canary.
Okay. And there were some virtual production studios you used, or was it all practical?
Everything was practical. I mean, I'm trying to think if there's an exception to that. But no, I mean, we had every spaceship was built, every room was constructed. So we had a lot of sets.
Sure.
And then obviously locations, we used real locations and didn't use, with the exception of what I mentioned in Germany.
Yeah.
It was all the real thing. Actors were on the real, dealing with the real deal, so to speak.
Sure. And how does that affect you when you're shooting it, if it's practical rather than having VFX? Is that making it easier for you or just different?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I'm a Luddite. I like sort of that old school thing. I think a room or, the placement of a window or something kind of can inform an approach. I've never done a fully CG set. And I think I'd be, it may be liberating, but at the moment I feel like I'd be a little bit lost. I love being in a space, particularly location, and even obviously well-built sets. Like, and Roy did an amazing job with the set. It gives you a feel for the place. And then, as you get to know it, you can play with it as well and say, okay, wouldn't it be cool if in this scene we change this up to make it feel more like that? Or, and I think the actors must love it. I can't imagine being an actor sort of standing sort of in the middle of a, empty expanse and having a sense of the place. It's difficult. I think I'm old school. I like being in a spot, and I think it informs the approach in every regard, probably.
Yeah. Can you just talk to us a little bit about the relationship between you and the production designer? I mean, obviously that's quite key. And I think you worked with him before on American Gods and Lock and Key, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, he's actually coming over for dinner afterwards, I'm sure. We're good friends. So,
we should have got him on the podcast.
Yeah, it's true, yeah. Well, I think he's not going to be here till after we're done. Yeah, he's a lovely guy, an immense talent, a crazy imagination, which I love. And we've, I think, developed a real shorthand. He's fantastic because he's got these sometimes wonderfully off-the-wall approaches, but he's not opposed to amending them for the purposes of, let's say, camera or lighting or even direction. Like, he's malleable in his approach, and he works. He's a real collaborator, I guess is the best way to put it. So, and now we've developed a bit of a shorthand, having worked together a bunch, and I think a similar aesthetic. We tend to like the same thing, so it makes it really easy to work with him. The real issue sometimes with television is, unlike film, a director of photography is brought in later in the process, so sometimes the production designer will have to go ahead and make a number of choices that may affect my job or a director's job, and not necessarily have the input they may want to sort of make it workable for all departments. But I mean, in a case like Rory's, I think he's very aware of that. He's often saying, okay, well, why don't we just blow this wall out and put a window here? Or, he's very open to those kinds of discussions, which is a godsend and a lifesaver.
Can you just walk us through how you work together, for example, to build the lamps in the sets, like the spaceship interior? And did this contribute to how you styled the framing when shooting?
A lot of that was, I think, Roy had a lot of the base stuff put into all the ship. Right. A lot of the base sort of decorative lighting, so to speak. And then if there was something where, like, okay, here's the blocking. We'd always, almost always have some practical set or lights, built that would match the aesthetic of the set. And then we could be like, okay, well, let's stick that one here, stick that one there. Where can we hide something here if necessary? So yep. There was a lot of that kind of, messing around. And there was always something to play with in terms of how we could move a few things around. It was great.
Right. Okay.
All those sets were expertly wired by a practical lighting guy in Ireland, Dean Brogan, did an amazing job. And I don't know how many miles of LED, probably from, twice around the Earth. I don't know. It seems like it could have been much. It was an incredible amount. So.
Yeah. What were the challenges in rigging some of the, when you were shooting the enormous exterior sets? Was that quite a challenge for you?
There's a few things. Like the challenges in Malta were obviously, doing some of those bigger night exteriors of people on water, which I guess in a sense they were locations, not sets. It was challenging because obviously we were on a coastal region, so sometimes we were pelted by the wind and the rain, and obviously we're working on water, which is horribly slow, and can really try your patience. But so that was a logistical challenge.
Sure.
There were two great gaffers. Like the main gaffer for the show was Barry Conroy, who was fantastic. Who had it all kind of planned out and gave a lot of flexibility and kind of surrounded the giant water tank in Malta with workable lights that we could, say, okay, well, we're looking this way now, swing this one up or let's get that on our list or let's do that. And even getting lights out onto the water at times. And then another excellent right-hand man, Ian Kearney, who did a lot of the work in Malta and the Canaries. Both of those guys were fantastic. Also Simon McGee, who I didn't work with, but all of them had to sort of coordinate the various units. And we had a well thought out lighting plan for that. And then Terminus, obviously, a lot of that work that was large night exteriors, for example, or even sometimes similar stuff in the day, a lot of the practical lighting that was put into the sets was really useful. And again, a well thought out plan. And we had to be flexible between multiple units. So there was a lot of kind of like, okay, well, this unit wants to do this here, that unit wants to do that there. They were sort of able to give us a lot of great tools that made it possible.
Okay. Can we just talk a little bit about the visual language of the show for a second? And then we can start maybe with the framing choices that you did. So some scenes, I think, we were looking at, made a great use of symmetry and central framing for the actors. So how did you decide when in the story to use that symmetry?
I think Alex Graves is a great fan of symmetry. I think he has a predisposition to it for a lot of things. But I do know that, for example, and I can kind of relate to that, to be honest. But for example, characters like Demerzel were almost always framed sort of symmetrically, sort of to kind of suggest the mechanical nature and the perfection of her. I don't know if I'm doing a spoiler here. I don't think I am. Her being a robot. So those kinds of choices, I think, definitely sort of informed her coverage. And then I noticed, and I'm speaking out of turn because he may think differently, but maybe this is my interpretation of his choices in that regard. But he wanted to frame someone sort of more symmetrically as a matter of emphasis. Now, of course, we got the set and everything else. Sometimes that could just be a purely aesthetic choice, but I felt like that was a thing that he liked to do, just give emphasis by putting them in the center of frame.
Right. Okay. And there's some beautiful use of transitions between some of the scenes. What were the discussions in deciding, again, where to use those and when not to?
A lot of those were, again, worked out by Alex. I think he has a real love for that, and I have to give him credit. He did some beautiful ones. I think the idea behind that, and sort of paraphrasing here, I think like the show jumped narratively from a lot of different places.
Yeah.
And to a lot of different even time. And a lot of the sort of thinking behind that is to sort of give like a visual connection between one scene to the next. Like you can do an abrupt cut and suddenly you're taking somebody out of something and taking them immediately into something else for you know, and that has its own effect. But the some of those transitions, I think, just let you flow from one idea and one sort of moment in the story to the next. And they have the overriding effect of connecting them, I think, visually and thematically, because you know that this moment flows into that moment. And even if the direct, you know, the viewer doesn't feel that or think of that intellectually, I think they feel that. And I think he did a really great job doing that, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it looks terrific. And can we move on to maybe the color for a moment? And what were the conversations between yourself and the director and the costume and art department regarding the colors on the production? You know, in terms of you know, the use of color, possibly for the character, the location, the time period in the story.
Yeah, definitely with like costume. And things like that. I think a lot of the colors were evocative of the locations and meant to mirror them. And I think sort of to make them a fully realized visual concept. And then colored lighting. I mean, Steve did some lovely stuff in episode one with some of those colors. And then for me, I know I was talking with Alex a bit and David that the Imperial Palace and even like we reshot Harry's study in episode one when he first meets Gale, and some of those places I swang into the warmer colors and sort of the warmer tones. My overriding reason there was like I felt like it was an empire in twilight, and I wanted to sort of suggest that way. And I figured absolutely no one would get it, but I actually kind of came across one review, and I can't remember who she was. I wanted to send her flowers. She's like, oh yeah, I think you did it this for this. And I was like, yes, I did. Yes. She kind of got the idea. So that was kind of like the, an empire in kind of twilight was those warm tones, fire, like sort of a low sun feel. And obviously sometimes we play it against a cooler temperature for emphasis, but that was kind of the idea there. And then Synax sort of had that a bit of green and blue put into it to sort of suggest that milieu kind of thing. And make it feel like a different place. Like it sort of was a, you know, sort of where Gal kind of starts, or Gale sort of starts and loses her, or takes her first leap, kind of loses a bit of innocence there. So that kind of green and blue and that kind of naturalism, or the natural tones, excuse me, was sort of the idea there. And then things like the Maiden, I think, which Owen McCollum did a great job with, and Kaho Waters did a wonderful job with, you know, they were meant to feel like a bit of a desert planet and a bit sort of hyper religious. So again, we swung back into a kind of a warm tone there.
Okay. And just to get onto my favorite topic, probably, which is the greatest part of the look, I think, for me anyway, is the lighting, you know, the use of darkness rather than light, the use of backlight. And there seems to be a theme throughout the creative layers of light within the darkness, which I think is super. I really enjoy that. So what was behind the decision to light it like that?
Always, I think, sort of story. I think nobody wanted a poppy, sort of bright sci-fi epic. And a lot of times a bit of darkness suggests sort of visually has, you know, suggest a bit of weight. And it's a, you know, it's a weighty story. It's about civilization. Mm-hmm. It's about knowledge. It's, I don't know what it's not about, really, you could say. So I think, you know, that really kind of felt right to sort of say, well, it's a dim world, and the empire, like I was sort of suggesting earlier, is getting dimmer. And then out in the places like Terminus, particularly, when things go south, which is what I covered in my episode, the sort of the beginnings of an invasion, that had to have some heaviness to it in terms of it had to have a bit of a spooky element, particularly either when Salvor goes looking for the boy or in an abandoned ship or whatever. We wanted that to have a bit of, you know, it had to feel a little ominous. And then there's this sequence on the Raven, which is particularly dark. Gale arrives in her life pod and is alone on the ship. And it wanted to feel like a horror movie. Like that was the, you know, that was definitely the sort of directive from David and Alex, like this should be kind of scary, you know, and it should feel lonely and it should feel heavy. And that shit progresses. I think it gets much brighter and, the mood changes later on, but that was how we wanted it started.
Sure. And can you tell us about the lights within the package, what was built into the set and what was used on the floor?
There's a lot. We relied really heavily on LEDs in the set, just because of their flexibility. Obviously, their workability, they can, you know, they can be easily adapted, they can be easily changed. Particularly, a lot of the stuff inside the sets was RGBs. If you wanted to change its color, which I couldn't do too much, it was there to have that option. If you wanted to cool it down and brighten it up, it saves so much time. And it's just so flexible. And then on the floor, you know, we generally tended towards, except for harder sources, we tended towards the LEDs like sky panels, light mat, things like that.
And in the Cleon's Palace, you got some flickering fire lamps, I think, in the background. What did you use for these?
Yeah, it was a mixed bag. Generally, we'd often go to sky panels, like S30s or S60s. Sometimes we use the stair tubes, Titan tubes, to get a bit of that if it was a tighter space. We did use real fire quite a bit. And obviously, I kind of prefer that to almost anything if it's possible. Sometimes it's not possible for safety concerns or for obviously sure. air quality. But yeah, those are usually it's some sort of LED source that was. Then we had a great board office that could sort of give us that good fire effect if it wasn't perfect out of the box.
Sure. And can you talk a little bit about the choices of hard and soft sources to pick out the layers of the detail in terms of the architect and you know, the actual sets themselves?
Yeah, I mean, Barry the Gaffer will probably, you know, agree heavily with this. I am terrified of hard sources as a key light. And I think that's a particular failing of mine, because I just don't know how to use them properly, because I've seen some other cinematographers use them to great effect and really beautifully. I haven't got there yet, something to work on certainly, but I like hard light either as a backlight or deep in the background as an accent light. And I really like to work with left light in the foreground as a key light. But usually for me anyway, those hard lights would be just to make something somewhat visually striking, like a shaft of light, or to pick up a piece of set somewhere in the background. And then beyond that, I love soft lights, and maybe I'm getting too comfortable with some places that I don't know. If you ask my gaffer, he'd say yes, but get out of your comfort zone, which is probably true for all of us when we get to the job. But we'll see how I do season two.
Okay. Let's move on to one of the sets, I think, that we sent you, one of the images about the lighting in the abandoned spaceship in Terminus, and there was a torch light on the rifle.
Mm-hmm.
This can be quite challenging, maintaining the light on the face of the person with holding the light source when keeping a dark atmosphere on set. So could you just talk us through how you manage that?
Yeah, that whole set was kind of a huge homage to the first Alien there. We wanted to keep it super moody with big sort of bold sources coming in, some shafts of light coming into the holes in the set.
Yeah.
And the gun was going to be a big part of that, and the light there on. But there's an amazing props master on this job, Paul Stewart, who also built a little light. And so in the scope, there'd be a light on the rifle pointing forward. But in the back of the scope, he built a beautiful little LED that we could manipulate and just cast a tiny bit of light back on that. Just push it back on her face a little bit and just get the kind of exposure we need. So the symbol is great. And he's put them in all the guns. And again, he's a lifesaver. He's kind of a mad genius with these great ideas. And that was, we ended up using it extensively for a lot of the night work, a lot of the stuff where she has to go, you know, scoping through the darkness. And the great part about that is it sort of frees you to kind of let you're not struggling with a key light in a case like the way she played that scene. We weren't struggling trying to light her everywhere that was important, because in each of those cases, she had the gun through her eye and it would work out quite wonderfully. And when she gets into there's a bigger hall where she finds kind of a monster, a bishop claw, or more like an animal, I guess. And this is before she's also discovered by the invading force. She was just expertly lighting herself. She just set up a bounce card and then get the actor to swing it into the right spot at the right time and shoot it. She did a great job. Right. So she should take credit for the lighting in that scene, maybe. I don't know.
There's some great texture as well to the atmosphere picked up by the light sources. So what did you use for that?
I'm a huge fan of things like mole beams. I like strong. That's where I like hard light, hard focus light. And we use, like, again, in that set, we use them as shafts. And in a case like in Malta, where Gail is on the water, she, two times, I think, she goes to the abandoned university and then she goes to retrieve a message from Shifty Synaxian. In that case, we're using a bunch of soft lights. So we rimmed the entire tank with I don't know how many, a large number of S60s, the sky panel S60s. And then we had our expert VFX or SFX teams blow smoke just along the edge of the tank. The wind was cooperating brilliantly, and we just uplit that just to give some shape there.
Sure.
So, yeah, it worked out really well. I like that. I was pleased with it. We got lucky, though.
Yeah. Because on the night scenes in Cinex, as you say, with Aaron Sohn, there's some really interesting hard lights on the faces there and the use of practical lanterns, I think, holding in place around the set. So how did you manage to get the principal lights again on the faces so perfect? Because it looks, just spot on.
Yeah, I only see the mistakes. I'm like, oh, if I only had just brought it around another few degrees. But I keep saying so. That's pretty good. It was the fantastic prop team that built us some lamps in conjunction with our expert lighting team. So they built them cleverly to have an open top in the sense that there was four-sided diffusion on the lamp, and then the top had a piece that we could supplant for diffusion as well to try to give a bit of a kick up. And so... yeah, and they were completely remotely controlled and dimmable and all that kind of stuff. It was pretty fantastic.
Sure. In terms of the underwater scenes with Gail rescuing the book from Aaron Sohn, obviously he's been executed at this point. So could you talk us through that, the planning of that? Did you get involved in the underwater shooting?
Yeah, I mean, we had the underwater operator, who was quite an accomplished underwater cameraman, in his own right, and I think did shoot a bunch of stuff as a second unit underwater for sure, with a huge help. His name is Pete Zigarini, maybe fairly world-renowned for his abilities in that regard. So we had to shoot that in a small tank in Malta, schedule-wise, and because it was something that tank, a smaller tank, we could heat. So it's immediately adjacent to the large tank in Malta, and a lot of our resources were there. So the art department sort of expertly kind of, dressed that, did a number of tests. And then the shafts of light back there were meant to sort of mimic the rings of Synax and try to suggest that same idea as though they were giving that light. I mean, I remember reading the script going, okay, night underwater. just sketching going, oh no, how am I going to do this? But, anyway, Pete Degree and his team are great, and they worked in conjunction with Barry and myself, and we kind of, muscled. It's never quick, ever, but we muscled some stuff around and, kind of got it to the fairly right place, I think, went from there. Couldn't have done it without those guys, so no chance.
Yeah, I guess you've got in your mind how it should look, and then it's trying to replicate that action. So.
Yeah. Well, it's not like you can have a stand underwater. I mean, an actor dives down there for a number of seconds. You might get a stunt person to dive down again for a number of seconds. Anybody else has a mask and a breather on, so you can't really, you have to kind of, you've got to sort of try the broad strokes a bit, and there's no real ability to refine. You can't have someone stand on their mark. You have to kind of, it's tricky. But again, those guys had a lot of great suggestions and were super helpful, so it worked out.
In terms of the VFX and, the model unit, did you get involved in that process in terms of shooting the miniatures as well?
No. I was blissfully unaware of what was going on there. Yeah, they did some great stuff. Obviously, they took some of their cues from what we did, and we took some of our cues from what they did, but I wasn't particularly involved with that. I think all of the main unit cinematographers, they had their own sort of unit going. Sure. Occasionally, there were a few people that, some of the second unit guys that popped in to help them out, but we were mostly separate.
Okay. A few questions about the schedule, really. The production shut down, I think, for about 6 months, was it, because of COVID? And I think you ended up shooting a few more scenes in Malta than you thought you were going to originally. So how did that affect the shooting of your episodes? Were you particularly affected?
Well, it was pretty crazy, actually. I mean, an actor would, let's say, walk out of a door in Limerick in 2019, and then a year and a bit later would walk onto a location in Next Dairy Island, or vice versa, you know? So you'd be like, you'd be shooting things sometimes a year later, like completing a scene a year later. And that was challenging for sure. And, you know, sometimes, especially since we shot the Limerick portion first and the studio portion first, we'd light it with an idea of what we were going to encounter in the Canaries. And then again, a year later, we'd be like, I got lucky, or we didn't. So there was that. Some actors had fallen off the schedule because they couldn't come back in time for us to finish. Like Clark Peters, for example, I think we shot him in 2019, and then we shot a bunch of scenes without him because he was, unfortunately, once he came back from COVID, he had already been contracted to another job. We couldn't have him until 2021 or whatever, but we got to the Canary. So we'd shoot all around him with body doubles and then finish our angles in the Canary. So stuff work that had started in Limerick, we then finished the scene again a year and a half later with his close-ups elsewhere. So it was a challenge. It was really kind of cool. But it was, sometimes you just be like, oh my gosh. But yeah, definitely, definitely not shot in order, and definitely there's a lot of moving parts that way.
Sure. I was going to ask how long it would generally take to shoot an episode, but I guess with that going on, you could say 3 years, couldn't you?
Yeah. Well, you could in this case, yeah, almost, yeah. usually you couldn't, but in this case you could.
Yeah, sure. It's incredible. Okay. In terms of the grid, was it the first time you saw all the elements together when you went into the grid, you know, with the model unit and the CGI?
Chris would often give us, Chris McLean, our VFX supervisor, who's a fantastic guy, would often give us concept drawings. Well, always give us concept drawings. And for the more complicated sequences, he'd give us pre-visits. So we had some idea of how it was all going to come together, definitely. But then, I mean, they did such a fantastic job on so much of it. Like, when I went in to do the grade, there was a couple times that's just like, yeah, I was dumbstruck, because some of it's just so beautiful what they did. And some of the work they did on Synax, particularly in the pilot, kind of stuff is just so wonderfully seamless. It doesn't draw too much attention to itself, and it adds to the story. And I think that's one of the sort of overriding ethoses of the VFX department. On Foundation, which is a tricky thing to do on a sci-fi show, but they don't want to draw too much attention to themselves. Chris was a big fan of and a big proponent of making sure that what he does only kind of adds to the story, doesn't distract from the story. And you know, there's some fantastic examples of that all over the place. I mean, so many seamless VFX that people would never know were even there, and they just sort of take it places that it could never go on its own. So anyway, seeing that in the final grade was pretty spectacular. Great. Fantastic.
Was there anything specifically that you wanted to push in grade, or when it went into the grade? Are the colors, or?
I was again sort of trying to kind of keep that sort of naturalism going, and I wanted to, and I think David Goyer and Tony Dustin, who was the colorist at Company 3 in Toronto, we all wanted to kind of keep that alive, and keep that sort of feeling going. But also, I think David and Tony and myself tend to gravitate towards the darker images, and sort of, but I love darkness when I can see all the way into it. so that the shadows aren't completely gone. You can still have some detail back there. And they were all on the same page that way. So that's one thing. We tried to ride that line. Now, it's tricky in the streaming world to pull that off because sometimes, depending on where someone's watching something or what they're watching it on, you don't know if you cross the line or what side of the line you're on, but you can do the best you can do and hope that it gets there.
Have you got a scene that you could tell us about, your favorite scene that you shot between the three episodes you did?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the stuff on Synax, for sure. Absolutely. I don't know. No, there's so many. I couldn't tell you what my favorite was. Like, there's so many things that I enjoyed and I felt good about, and you know, and that I would love to sort of try to replicate. I mean, that goes hand in hand with all the mistakes that I see when I look at it. But Synax, I think, was a really great challenge and a lot of fun to try to kind of give it a vibe and a kind of build a little bit of a world, because you got to kind of go at that. Pretty clear. So that was probably my favorite.
Right. Well, as I say, I really enjoyed it so far. I've only got so many episodes in, but it's looking really, really good. Finally, I don't know whether you can tell me, but is there anything, you know, what's coming up next for you in terms of shooting?
Well, I think based here on our conversation, season two, I'm going to learn how to use hard light. That's what it sounds like I have to do. So, yeah. And yeah, watch out for those strong hard light, key light, and see how I do. I don't know. Try to get out of the usual. Try to get yourself out of the comfort zone. I had a great mentor once. He told me, if you ever sit down and look at your work and think you're a genius or think it's amazing, then it's time for you to do something else. So,
yeah.
See.
Well, unfortunately, we've got to wrap it, I think, now with podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Tico. And thanks for your time today on the Visual Impact Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was cinematographer Tico Poulakakis, CSC, talking about his work on Foundation. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please head over to our website, visuals.co.uk, where you can subscribe to the show and listen to more exclusive content.